Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we are opening a file that is, frankly, it's bizarre. It is epic. It is terrifying.
And it smells faintly of aged Gouda.
It really does. A very distinct, pungent aroma of cheese and existential dread.
That's the perfect combination.
We are looking at the campaign records for the Twilight Enclave. And if you're listening to this and you're familiar with tabletop role-playing games, you probably know the reputation of this specific story.
Oh, it's infamous.
It's a narrative that starts in a restaurant basement fighting rats and ends with the potential dissolution of all reality.
It's quite the escalation. You go from pest control to cosmic horror in the span of what feels like, I don't know, three sessions. It really highlights how quickly things can spiral when you have the wrong...
Or maybe the right.
Or perhaps the right group of adventurers.
Yeah. Exactly. So here is our mission for this deep dive. We have a stack of source material here. Campaign notes, session summaries, character journals, and some very, very fragmented lore Bibles.
Very fragmented.
Our goal is to untangle the web of the Twilight Enclave. We need to understand this Deck of Fates conspiracy. We need to figure out who killed Thad the Smuggler.
And we need to figure out why the architecture in this city can't make up its mind.
That's a big one. But we have to do all of that while acknowledging a very specific, very strange condition of these records.
Right. The meta disclaimer. We have to address this up front because it colors everything we're about to discuss.
It really does.
We do. The records for the Twilight Enclave are, well, they're fragmented. There are gaps. We have entire timelines where the ink is smudged or the pages are simply missing.
Right.
Now, in a normal analysis of a text, we'd call this lost data or maybe just bad record keeping.
Sure.
But within the context of this campaign, these gaps are treated as canonical. They are attributed to divine intervention, or more ominously, corruption by the void.
Or the occasional GM memory loss, which I think is just a polite euphemism for a reality-eating entity consuming the timeline.
It's a very convenient narrative device for when you forget what happened 3 weeks ago, certainly.
Mm.
But yes, strictly in-universe, it implies that the fabric of the story is actively fraying. The history of this world isn't set in stone. It's being eaten.
Which is terrifying.
And there is one other crucial anomaly we need to flag before we dive in, something that came directly from our listener notes.
The set versus gizmo situation.
Correct. This is fascinating from a player psychology standpoint. For the first, what, two-thirds of the saga, one of the central figures is Set, a tiefling philosopher, a monk and warlock. He's the moral compass.
That's why asking the big questions.
Exactly. But then there's a hard pivot. Set remains behind in a pocket dimension, and the narrative focus shifts instantly to Gizmo, an autognome.
Played by the same force, the same player.
Exactly. And while that sounds like a game mechanic, just swapping characters because you're bored or your character concept isn't working.
Which happens all the time.
All the time. But the story treats it as a massive narrative beat. Set is the observer, staying safe in the garden. Gizmo is the active variable, walking right into the line of fire. We have to keep that duality in mind as we go through this.
It's not just a roster change. It's a shift in the party's soul.
That's a great way to put it.
Okay. Void corruption.
Mm-hmm.
Character swaps. Missing notes. We are primed. Let's go back to the beginning, the inciting incident. Because honestly, looking at these notes, I can't believe the fate of the multiverse rests on a group of people who were hired to kill rats.
It's the classic humble beginnings trope, but, you know, twisted into a pretzel. The party wakes up in the basement of the Balanced Scale restaurant in Sigil, the City of Doors.
Center of the multiverse.
The very same. They have fragmented memories, already hinting at that void theme. And they aren't fighting giant spiders or goblins. They're fighting the cheese cult of Ratsputin.
Ratsputin. I need a moment to appreciate that name. It's just so good.
Yeah. It is brilliant. It's a collective of cranium rats. Now, cranium rats are typically, you know, terrifying psychic spies for mind flayers.
Yeah, they're nightmare fuel.
Pure nightmare fuel. But these ones, they are wearing tiny little hand-sewn robes. They are convinced that they are the avatar of the cheese god. They have formed an entire theology around dairy.
I love everything about this. It sets the tone perfectly. You have this absurdity, psychic rats chanting for Brie, but then you look at how the party solved it.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't just stab the rats. That would be too simple.
Too pedestrian for this group. No, they decided the best way to handle a basement full of psychic vermin was to drive the entire swarm up the stairs into the main dining room.
know.
During peak dinner service.
Which is just, that's chaotic, neutral behavior at its absolute finest.
It is. But look at the fallout. It's not just a funny moment. It destroys the restaurant's reputation. It puts the owner, a man named Meridian, in a desperate spot. He's facing financial ruin because his patrons were swarmed by religious rodents.
And that desperation, that chaos, it creates the vacuum that Lysandra steps into.
Precisely. Enter the quest givers. Meridian, the very angry, very desperate restaurant owner, and Lysandra, this mysterious observer who was just watching the chaos unfold.
Almost enjoying it from the notes.
Almost, yeah. And they offer the party a way out, a simple delivery job. Take this deck of cards to our contact, Thad, in the Twilight Enclave. Simple, right?
It's never simple. And this is where the great deception happens.
Yeah.
This is the moment the trap snaps shut.
It really is. The party is told they're delivering a deck of many things.
Which, for those who don't know, is basically a magical hand grenade. You draw a card, you might become a king, you might lose your soul, you might summon a celestial avatar from the heavens to smite your enemies.
Or yourself.
Or yourself. It's a pure chaos.
High stakes gambling with reality itself. But Lysandra, she's playing a different game. She switches the decks. She keeps the real artifact, the chaos generator. And gives them a deck of fates.
Deck of fates. What's the difference?
The deck of many things is chaos. The deck of fates is control. It's destiny. And then she has her agent, a guy named Brandon Thad's partner, trick them into drawing from it.
This scene at the Tavern of Three Truths, it's painful to read because you just see it coming from a mile away. Tigo's the halfling. He grabs a card.
Impulsiveness is a defining trait for Tigas. He just acts. He draws. And the deck of fates isn't about random chaos. It's about binding destiny. It's a railroad.
So what happens?
The moment he draws, a magical contract is stamped onto his lifeline. He is compelled magically to find Thad and discover the truth.
It's basically a magical subplot hook that you physically cannot ignore.
It's a geas,
right.
A magical command woven into his very being. And the rest of the party, they see their friend get magically conscripted and they join him.
Yeah, that surprised me. They didn't have to draw. Brandon only tricked Tigo's.
They didn't. And this moment tells you so much about the group. It's a twisted form of solidarity. To save him, or at least to share the burden so he doesn't march to his doom alone, they all draw.
One by one.
One by one, they accept the binding. So what looked like a simple delivery job is now a cosmic obligation. They are magically incapable of abandoning this mystery.
That is such a crucial distinction. They aren't heroes because they chose to be. They are heroes because they were tricked into a contract they can't break.
Precisely. And that contract drags them, kicking and screaming, to the setting of our deep dive, the Twilight Enclave.
Let's unpack the setting, because the visuals here are wild. We're in the Outlands. There is a floating island called Thracia.
A classic.
And in the center is the city of Concordance. But Concordance feels like an ironic name, doesn't it?
Completely ironic. Concordance implies harmony, agreement. This city is visually and physically tearing itself apart.
Describe it for us.
You have to imagine walking down a street. On your left, you have a Germanic, Norse-style, longhouse, heavy timber, thatched roof, smoke curling from a chimney. On your right, a pristine, white marble Greek temple with perfect columns. And at the end of the block, a sandstone Egyptian obelisk rising out of the cobblestones.
And the notes say this isn't just distinct neighborhoods like in a modern city. It's bleeding, is that the term?
It's a reality bleed. That's the specific term the notes use.
Yeah.
A building isn't just built in a style, it shifts. You go to sleep in a timber-framed inn, you wake up, and the columns in the common room have turned to fluted marble, and the roof is now a flat stone affair with hieroglyphs.
That's horrifying.
The architecture is fighting a war with itself.
It's like the city is having an identity crisis on a metaphysical level.
And that's because it is. You have three factions fighting for dominance over this reality. You have the Twilight Folk, the original inhabitants, represented by that Germanic Norse style. They are trying to hold on to the original balance of the island.
The status quo.
The status quo. Then you have the Greek faction, bringing the Order of Athena, logic, strategy, marble columns. And the Egyptian faction, channeling the chaos of Set. Desert winds, sand, corruption.
So it's order versus chaos versus balance,
right.
Represented by bricks and mortar.
Exactly. And here is where the analyst in me gets excited. This reality bleed, it's not just flavor text, it's evidence. It's the key piece of evidence.
For what?
It suggests that the original deck of many things, the one Lysandra kept, is being used nearby. That artifact creates and destroys reality if someone is messing with the source code of the universe in the vicinity.
The city's architecture is the glitch. the graphical error.
That is a fantastic way to put it, yes. The GPU of reality is overheating and textures are popping in and out all over the place.
Okay, so we have our reluctant heroes who are magically bound, trapped in a glitching city.
Yeah.
Let's look at the team. The Warlocks of Concordance. And they are all warlocks, aren't they?
Every single one of them, in some capacity.
Yeah.
Which implies a heavy, heavy theme of debt and obligation. Warlocks are defined by their pacts. They don't study for magic like wizards. They buy it. They bargain for it. They all owe something to someone powerful.
Let's start with Teagaus, the catalyst.
Teagaus is fascinating. Halfling rogue warlock. He's the one who drew the card first, the impulsive one. But there's something darker hanging over him. There was a divine augury, a fortune-telling session involving a pig sacrifice that went horribly, horribly wrong.
As pig sacrifices often do.
Rarely do they go right. The heavens opened up, a voice boomed, and it proclaimed a prophecy. Teagaus is destined to bring about the destruction of all existence.
No pressure, just a casual Tuesday prophecy to deal with.
None at all. And to make it worse, he carries a temporal blade.
A time sword.
A weapon that is canonically involved in a closed time loop. So you have a guy who is impulsive, carrying a time travel sword, and who is destined to end the world. He is a walking, talking doomsday clock.
That is a terrible combination of traits.
Dripper words.
Then we have Genesis, the analyst, a warforged, so a magical construct.
Genesis brings this fish out of water perspective,
yeah.
But specifically regarding souls and contracts. There is this chilling moment in the notes where Genesis reads the contract from the Thieves Guild, we'll get to them later, and realizes it's a soul slavery situation.
What does that mean?
Because Genesis is a construct, she looks at the logic, the math of it, and she says, death cannot break this contract. Our obligation continues. For everyone else, death is an escape. For Genesis, it's just a change in state. The debt remains.
That is horrifying. And she's followed by a teapot.
A void reactive teapot, yes. It pours a viscous black liquid. It just follows her around. It's a direct physical link to the cosmic horror element we mentioned earlier. It suggests Genesis is tethered to something outside normal reality.
It's almost like a mascot for the apocalypse.
That's exactly what it is.
And there's LT, half-elf, warlock cleric.
LT is the duality. He is torn between two patrons, a fiend from the lower planes and a celestial from the upper planes. He is literally the battleground for good and evil. His soul is a tug of war.
That's a classic conflict.
It is. But the running gag with LT is my favorite part of the character dynamics. He desperately wants to cast Speak with Dead to solve the murder of Thad.
But to cast Speak with Dead, you need...
Yeah.
Well, a dead body.
You do. Or you need to be near death yourself to sort of bridge the gap between worlds. LT keeps trying to walk into dangerous situations to trigger his death powers, but his luck, or maybe his patrons protecting their investment, won't let him die.
So he's the suicidal detective who is cursed with survival.
Exactly. He walks into a dragon's breath and it sneezes. He jumps off a cliff and a griffin catches him. It's cosmic irony.
And finally, Entebbe, the shopper.
Entebbe is the meta joke character who accidentally became serious. He's from Core Earth. He implies he's from the real world, maybe even our world.
A fourth wall break.
A huge one. He has a dream key and the contract that's literally written on the skin of his arm. He represents the intrusion of outside reality into their story.
So that's the squad. But we have to talk about the pivot. We mentioned it in the intro, and the listener feedback specifically pointed this out, the set to gizmo swap. Because this isn't just my character died, here's a new one.
Mm-hmm.
This was a deliberate narrative choice.
It's absolutely deliberate, and it changes everything. Set, the tiefling philosopher, was the moral center for a long time. He was a monk warlock, very focused on the why of things. Why is reality bleeding? What is the nature of the void?
The big picture guy.
The biggest picture. But about two-thirds through the available records, Set decides to stay in the Eternal Garden.
The garden is a pocket dimension, right? Time moves differently there.
Correct. One day inside is 1 year outside. It's a place of contemplation. Set stays there to study the philosophical implications of the reality distortions. He effectively removes himself from the board. He pauses his own timeline to think.
And in his place, the player introduces Gizmo.
An autognome. A little clockwork person found deep in the caverns of Thracia.
And Gizmo isn't just a random robot they stumble upon.
No, this is the crucial part. Gizmo was part of Thad's original expedition, the expedition that went wrong. And more than that, Gizmo holds a shard of the mask.
The mask?
The mask is a herald, an avatar of the void entity, Azathoth, the very thing that is eating reality.
So wait, let me get this straight.
Hmm.
The player swapped out a philosopher who was passively observing the end of the world for a robot who is physically carrying a piece of the entity that causes the end of the world.
That is exactly what happened. It is a massive escalation of personal stakes.
It makes you wonder if GM memory loss regarding Seth's adventures is actually just the timeline protecting itself by isolating him in the garden.
That's a very valid theory. Set is the backup file, stored safely off-site. Gizmo is the corrupted executable running on the main system. The player essentially decided, I don't want to just watch the fire anymore. I want to be the gasoline.
Wow. Okay, let's get to the central mystery. The reason they are all here in the first place. The murder of Thad.
Thad the smuggler. The man they are magically compelled to find. And they do. But not alive.
They find him in the Cave of Echoes. Behind a waterfall. And the description of the body is... it's very specific. It's forensic evidence of high-level magic.
Desiccation. Absolute total dehydration. All fluids aged out of his body instantly. He's a husk.
That's not a knife wound.
That's something.
That's not a fireball.
No. That is a temporal parasite. It's a creature, or maybe just an effect, that accelerates time, but only for liquids. It aged his blood into dust in a split second.
So that tells them something important.
It confirms that Thad wasn't just killed by a rival smuggler. He was killed by chronomancy, by time magic gone horribly wrong.
And because this is a D&D campaign, finding the body is just the beginning of the interrogation.
Of course.
They drag his desiccated corpse all the way back to Sigil to cast Speak with Dead.
Which is a grim visual, hauling a mummy through a magical portal. But the interrogation, it reveals the smoking gun. Thad's spirit admits he led an expedition. He went too deep into the caverns of Thracia. He found the Temple of Balance.
This is a pre-Pantheon location, right? Before the Greeks and Egyptians started their fight.
Exactly. It predates the entire conflict. It's an older, more fundamental place. And Thad broke a seal.
He let something out.
He let everything out. He released an entity. He calls it the Mask, or Izothos, an entity that eats reality. Thad was the only survivor of that expedition, but he carried the parasite back with him.
So he was patient zero for the temporal plague?
He was. But there's a second layer to his death. The trapped letter. Thad was carrying a letter given to him by Lysandra, intended for the gardener.
The ruler of the Eternal Garden, where Set is now.
The very same. But the gardener didn't open it. He's an archfey. He's clever. He sensed something was wrong and sent it back with the party.
And it was a trap.
It was a magical trap. A letter bomb. Lysandra wasn't sending mail. She was trying to assassinate an archfey. She wanted to silence the gardener because he knows the truth about the reality bleed and what's really happening.
This leads us perfectly into the triple cross. Because the party suddenly realizes they aren't just working for one sketchy person. They are caught between three massive competing powers.
It's a political triangle, and the party is the ball being kicked between all three points. It's a nightmare. Let's break down the employers.
Employer number one, Lysandra.
The manipulator. She faked the deck. She hired them. She tried to bomb the gardener. Her goal seems to be uncovering the truth, or perhaps controlling who gets to know the truth. She represents the Greek faction's strategy. Ruthlessness disguised as order and logic.
A greater good kind of villain.
Potentially, yes.
Employer number two, the gardener.
The archfey. He rules the Eternal Garden. He's the one who gave the party shelter. He wants to know who tried to kill him with that letter. He represents a third path. Isolationism, or perhaps preservation. He wants his garden to survive the void, and he doesn't care much about the city outside.
So he's not exactly a good guy, just a self-interested one.
Exactly. And then there's employer number three. This one came out of left field for me when I read the notes. The syndicate. Captain Valen, who also goes by the name Seraph. Now, usually you hear Thieves Guild, and you think pickpockets and fences.
Right. Guys in hoods stealing purses in dark alleys.
This is not that. This is a spelljammer criminal syndicate. They operate across crystal spheres. They have magical spaceships. They're a multiplanar corporation of crime. And their contract, the one Genesis analyzed, it claims the party's souls, even after death.
That is terrifying. Why do they want Thad's info? What's in it for them?
Profit. Power. If Thad found a way to manipulate reality or time, the syndicate wants to weaponize it. They want to sell it. They don't care about the architecture or the gods. They care about the market value of a reality-eating entity.
So the party is magically compelled by the deck, which ties them to Lysandra. They are legally bound by the syndicate's soul contract, and they are morally obligated to the gardener who saved them.
It is the definition of trapped. They have no good options. Their only way out is through.
And through means going to the source, the caverns of Thracia. and specifically Portal 427.
Thad's journal gave them that code, 427. It's a coordinate for the portal network in Sigil. It drops them right into the danger zone.
Let's visualize this dungeon, because the ecology of the caverns mirrors the city above. It's almost like archaeological layers of reality.
It's layers of history, literally. The upper levels are Greek ruins, Athena's influence, marble, statues, a sense of order. But as you go down, you hit the middle levels.
What's there?
This is the neutral zone, the remnants of the civilization that was there before the gods started fighting. It's older, more alien.
And below that?
The lower levels. That's where you find the Egyptian cultists. Set's influence, chaos, desert corruption spreading underground, sand filling ancient halls. But the real objective is below even that, the deepest level, the Temple of Balance.
This is where Thad broke the seal.
Yes, this is ground zero. This is where the ancient evil, the mask, Azathoth, was released. And this is why the reality bleed is happening on the surface. It's not just buildings changing. The void is leaking up from the bottom of the dungeon, infecting the layers above it one by one.
It's like a radiation leak, but instead of radiation, it's non-existence.
Precisely. The Greek and Egyptian factions are fighting over territory on the surface, rearranging the furniture on the Titanic, while the void is blowing a hole in the hull at the very bottom of the ocean.
That brings us to the meta-narrative, because we have to talk about the void in the context of the game itself. We mentioned earlier that the missing notes and GM memory loss are treated as canon.
This is my favorite part of this analysis. In most campaigns, if a session isn't recorded, it's just an annoyance for the lore keepers. Here, it's a symptom. The void entities, these black, blobby creatures that are described as hunting the party, they consume existence.
So when the party can't remember how they got from point A to point B, it's not bad record keeping. It's because the void ate that part of the timeline.
That is the direct implication. The timeline is fracturing just like the architecture. And we have proof of where this leads. Entebbe's dream key.
Right. Entebbe used this key at one point and saw a vision.
He saw concordance in the future. But it wasn't Egyptian or Greek or Norse. It was a burned out ruin. A dead city floating in the void. Silent.
Is that the inevitable future? Is that the destruction of all existence that Tigaz is prophesied to bring about?
That is the billion-dollar question. If Tigaz is the catalyst and the void is the mechanism, then the party is currently sprinting towards that exact future. And every time they use the Deck of Fates or use their warlock powers, they might just be accelerating the process.
It's horrifying, but it also loops back to the humor, which I think is so important to this whole story.
Mm.
We can't forget the rats.
We really can't, because in the middle of all this cosmic horror, soul slavery, time, parasites, void gods, you still have the cheese cult of Ratsputin. They're still down there, chanting.
Do they have a role in the endgame? Please tell me they do.
You know, in a story this chaotic, they might be the only ones immune to the void. Maybe the void can't digest pure, concentrated absurdity. Maybe cheese is the ultimate defense against non-existence.
I'd like to think that. So let's summarize the current situation, where the notes leave off. The party is currently standing at the precipice of Portal 427, injured, working for three different masters who all want to kill each other, carrying a time loop sword, and are probably still being hunted by a cheese cult.
It is a powder keg, and the match has already been lit and dropped. They're in free fall.
What stands out to you as the single most critical piece of this puzzle? If you had to bet on one thing, saving them or doing them, what is it?
It's the Deck of Fates. It has to be. We think of it as a trick Lysandra played on them, but if we connect this to the bigger picture, why does the deck exist? Why did it bind these specific people?
Mm.
I don't think it was just a trap. I think the deck acts as a focusing lens.
A lens? What do you mean?
Yes, it found the people who were capable of deciding the fate of reality. It didn't just grab randoms from a tavern. It grabbed a prophesied destroyer, a void-touched construct, a dual-souled cleric, and someone from outside their reality.
So it chose its champions.
Or its patsies. But it chose them for a reason. The deck might be the only thing keeping them anchored to reality while the void tries to wash them away.
So the curse is also their lifeline.
Exactly. Without that magical contract, they might have already been eaten by the missing notes. They'd just be another smudged entry in the campaign log.
That is a profound thought.
Right.
Okay, before we sign off, I have a provocation for you, a thought experiment to leave our listeners with.
Make me.
We talked about Set and Gizmo, the player swap. Set is safe in the Eternal Garden, studying philosophy, completely removed from danger. Gizmo is out here, carrying a piece of the apocalypse, risking his mechanical life.
Hmm.
Did the player swap save one soul only to sacrifice another?
Oh, that's That's a chilling question. Did he save the philosopher by creating the bomb?
Wow. And who is the they that the dream entity warned Entebbe about? The notes are very clear. The entity said it wasn't the syndicate, it wasn't the void, it was just they are watching.
If Set is the one observing from the safety of the garden, maybe they are the ones watching the story itself. Maybe they are us.
Or maybe it's something even the void is afraid of.
That's a thought that'll keep you up at night.
And on that existential bombshell, we are going to wrap up this deep dive into the Trilight Enclave.
Keep your decks shuffled.
And check your cheese for psychic resonance. We'll see you in the twilight.